This is Brian Forrester, and welcome to the Active Investor Podcast, part of Lord Abbett's Investment Conversation Series. In this podcast, we look at what we view are some of the most relevant near-term and longer-term drivers in the market. So thinking about investor behavior, risk factors, how changing market dynamics can influence security prices and investment strategies, and also through a secular lens where some of the big mega trends are building. And so today, we're going to dive into topics all around the credit markets and specifically into the more opportunistic areas of the market, high yield, bank loans, securitized, and also thinking about the range of performing to stressed and distressed. Now, we were supposed to record this episode a few weeks ago, but scheduling conflicts kept getting in the way. And I'm going to go ahead and say that was actually very fortuitous, given what's gone on in the banking sector and the ripple effects across credit markets over that time. I would say we've got plenty to talk about today. And for this episode, we welcome Eric Kang, who is heavily involved with opportunistic credit here at Lord Abbett. Eric is a managing director and portfolio manager on a number of strategies at the firm, including our credit opportunities and special situation strategies. And he's been in the industry for over 20 years. So, Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, just a quick programming note here. We originally started this podcast to focus on equities, and we found that there's been a particular demand of late around private credit, alternatives, and the growing focus on active management in the credit space. So with a podcast called The Active Investor, we felt it just made perfect sense to widen our purview and just focus on where we think active management makes the most sense rather than just one asset class. So with Eric here today, we're going to hone in on both what's been going on recently and also for some important color on how investment opportunities have evolved. What's been happening over, say, the last 15 years that's made opportunistic credit much more of an interesting asset class. So, Eric, let's start with a little of your background and how you found your way into credit investing. Maybe give us a brief summary of what got you on this path.
So my journey in credit started after business school when I joined a principal investing group at a large broker dealer. Now, we had a broad mandate. We had very flexible capital. And the interesting thing was there were a few groups at the firm that did very similar things. And so while this was a great learning experience, when the great financial crisis happened, the firm that I worked for and a lot of other firms like it, they just weren't quite so able to commit capital to this kind of investing. So I chose to join a large multi-strat hedge fund. That was a fantastic organization, but this was the middle of a financial crisis. And all firms that use leverage, they had to make decisions about capital efficiency. And so for me, this was a fantastic education in how that cost of liquidity can vary so massively during times of systemic shock. After that, I then worked for a couple other hedge funds. And increasingly, what I saw was that scale, scope capabilities, and business presence, they were just as critical as investing expertise was. And so then eventually, as I thought about all these experiences, it was clear that the world for credit investing has evolved and that a combination of breadth and depth of capabilities across sectors, the strength of the platform, and really ultimately an integrated team-based approach is what will be critical to delivering superior returns throughout credit cycles.
Thanks, Eric. So that's a bit of your own career and history as an investor. And as you alluded to, over the course of your 20 plus years in the markets, particularly since the GFC, a lot has changed structurally that has made periods of stress more frequent and provides more opportunities for someone like yourself. So can you walk us through some of the big changes in market dynamics and why that has created the need for more liquidity providers?
Sure. So coming out of the great financial crisis, the regulatory regime reset, it was pretty clear. Traditional intermediaries' bank balance sheets, they were resized lower. The regulatory intent was very clear: reduce balance sheet risk. Now, what was interesting about this is it was done in the backdrop of a zero interest rate policy. So what we had in credit was this really broad increase in risk taking, a lot of which was distributed to what we'll call the non-bank financial sector. Look, we've all seen the explosive growth in private credit. Some of that other growth was, a lot of it was into daily liquidity vehicles like ETFs. On the public side, what we've seen and felt since the great financial crisis is really the market trying to adapt to this new liquidity environment. So whether that's investors gravitating toward larger multi-tranche capital structures, or investors using tools like portfolio trades, or using more synthetics, or using ETF create redeem features, in normal times, you've seen the market get really creative in trying to adapt to this new liquidity regime. Now, what tends to be effective in normal times isn't always so effective in times of stress. Mm-hmm. Whether it's broader macro-driven risk-offs or moments where a specific company or credit has that moment of difficulty. And so what we've seen increasingly is more pronounced episodes of volatility. And oftentimes, these episodes of volatility, well, they're much more compressed than they were before the financial crisis. And so in these moments, what's supposed to be public and liquid doesn't always feel so public and liquid. Mm-hmm. And we think that these moments of stress, they present really unique opportunities for less traditional investors really to step into that void and provide liquidity.
So I guess that probably brings us right up to today, talking about the volatility with what's gone on with Silicon Valley Bank, other regional banks, and most recently with Credit Suisse. Who knows by the time this podcast reaches the street, maybe there's another one to that list. How are you thinking about the potential opportunity for investing as we emerge from this latest disruption?
Well, I think there's going to be an awful lot of postmortem with regard to Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, Credit Suisse, and others. And certainly there will be differing views around the causes for the crisis. There's going to be a lot of experts with a lot of different opinions. But I think the one thing that if we look forward that I feel pretty good about saying is that we're likely to see a regulatory response that rhymes a bit with what we saw coming out of the Great Financial Crisis. So I think we'll see a greater emphasis on increased capitalization at banks, better capitalized balance sheets. There's going to be more focus on systemic linkages. There will be tighter controls at financial institutions. What I don't think we're going to see coming out of this episode is some form of a reversion to pre-Great Financial Crisis conditions where traditional financial institutions used a large amount of balance sheet to take risk on a principal basis. In other words, I think we're likely to see a renewed shift in risk-taking to those non-bank hands. And really, depending on how that evidences itself, I think we're going to see that continued repricing of illiquidity premia. And so the opportunity set that we're really excited for as we look through this crisis and look ahead is that environment where we have that persistent level of volatility. That's an environment that's pretty well suited for strategies and really vehicles that have that flexibility of mandate and stability of capital.
Thanks, Eric. And when we look at one of the key new reasons for banks to be facing this stress, it's different than what the last war we fought in 2008, when it was all about bad underwriting, bad credit, and let's say the shared, highly levered exposure financial institutions had around the world that made it a systemic near disaster. Well, it would have been a disaster if not for the massive bailouts and policy rescues. So now it's asset liability mismatch and a few banks getting caught off sides with the big change in Fed policy following a really fast rate hike backdrop. I don't think many people were thinking about deposit flight and bank runs a few weeks ago, but here we are again dealing with at least another mini crisis, getting back to what you discussed earlier. So thinking more broadly about the credit cycle, where are we in this one? Are you and your team advocating for de-risking, or is this a time to be getting more opportunistic overall, maybe a little of both?
Well, I think the points you make, Brian, are spot on. I think if you rewound a year and just went back just 12 months, I think most people wouldn't have guessed that we would have seen stress points in UK pension funds and US regional banks. Those were not the most obvious places to look for trouble on the horizon. And while I think it's very early to say that we're completely out of the woods on this current crisis, I think it's very safe to say that with regard to credit, we're not mid-cycle anymore. Look, as you mentioned, the Fed acted very quickly against a pretty persistent inflationary backdrop. This is just that kind of environment where things break. So I don't think we've seen the end of overall stress. I think where we see that stress evidence itself, it may not be where investors traditionally go to look for trouble in economic downturns. I think one example is if you think about areas that had usually been high default sectors, areas that usually get in trouble, well, U.S. high-yield energy is kind of poster child for that. Well, this time, they're entering the downturn with relatively clean balance sheets. Right. Then you have other sectors where a decade and a half of very easy monetary policy, well, it's allowed for some less disciplined underwriting standards. So I think we may find stress and opportunities in unusual places. Now, against this backdrop, what's very interesting is that really for the first time in a decade and a half, there are attractive yields. There are attractive return profiles in areas of credit again. So we're absolutely not advocating for taking generic risk higher. We think implicitly that's accepting higher default rates. But this is absolutely the kind of environment where a more active and a more selective approach with the backdrop of broader volatility is one where you can find some very interesting opportunities.
Great. So one last question, Eric. Interval funds. That's been your preference in terms of structure for investing in opportunistic credit, at least up until now. We've actually written a piece on these types of vehicles called Interval Funds Explained that you can find on this podcast link. So just a little plug there for a nice explainer on these structures. Anyway, they're kind of a middle ground between daily priced public vehicles and then pure alternative private credit. The portfolio gets marked, investors get quarterly liquidity. Maybe just touch on why that interval structure has been an advantage as you look at opportunities in this space.
Sure. I think it's a lot of exactly what you just highlighted that makes us so excited about the structure, especially when it's combined with the flexible strategy. It is that middle ground between daily liquidity vehicles and longer term vehicles. And for those investors who have the ability to allocate part of their capital to just a slightly longer time horizon, the structure really allows us to do two things. I mean, first, it allows us to focus on those investment ideas that really are our best ideas, but sometimes they need a little bit of a longer horizon to realize value. Look, these situations sometimes quickly lose their traditional buyer base that has to consider a more traditional liquidity profile. So the right structure allows us to take advantage of that. And second, when we see those moments of wholesale repricing of risk in either direction, that certainty of capital allows our investors the ability to really view volatility as opportunity instead of a threat.
Great, thanks. And just as a reminder, these strategies can also be offered in institutional and offshore vehicles in addition to interval fund structures. So with that, I think we can wrap things up, and I'll just say thank you for joining the podcast, Eric. Some really good perspectives on credit and the markets today. Definitely look forward to having you back again later this year, maybe just to check in.
Brian, I've really enjoyed our conversation and look forward to continuing the discussion.
Great. Thanks, Eric. And for listeners wanting to learn more about Lord Abbott's views on the markets, please visit the insights section of lordabbott.com. And we'd also like to hear from our listeners. So if you have any comments about today's podcast or ideas for future podcasts, we welcome your thoughts and email at podcasts@lordabbott.com. And so we'll leave it there. This has been the Active Investor Podcast, and thank you for listening.
Special thanks to Lord Abbott, Senior Editorial Strategist Will Andrews, for assistance with this episode. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite streaming app of choice. The U.S. Federal Reserve is the central bank of the United States. The federal funds, or Fed funds rate, is the target interest rate set by the Fed at which commercial banks borrow and lend their excess reserves to each other overnight.
ETF refers to exchange-traded fund. An interval fund is a type of closed-end fund with shares that do not trade on the secondary market. Interval funds are not required to provide investors with daily liquidity. Rather, they will offer to repurchase a certain percentage of outstanding shares at set periods or intervals throughout the calendar year, often quarterly. A liquidity premium is any form of additional compensation that is required to encourage investment in assets that cannot be easily and efficiently converted into cash at fair market value.
Mentions of specific companies are for reference purposes only and are not meant to describe the investment merits of, or potential, or actual portfolio changes related to, securities of those companies.
Unless otherwise noted, all discussions are based on U.S. markets and U.S. monetary and fiscal policies. Market forecasts and projections are based on current market conditions and subject to change without notice. Projections should not be considered a guarantee. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbott speaker are those of the speaker as of the date of the broadcast and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. Any such views are subject to change at any time based upon market conditions or other conditions, and Lord Abbott disclaims any responsibility to update such views. This material is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, or investment advice. It is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities or to adopt any investment strategy. Neither Lord Abbott nor the Lord Abbott speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered.
None of the information provided should be regarded as a suggestion to engage in or refrain from any investment-related course of action, as neither Lord Abbott nor its affiliates are undertaking to provide impartial investment advice, act as an impartial advisor, or give advice in a fiduciary capacity.